Hello and welcome to the CMPL podcast. This month's podcast is actually a recording of a program that happens once a month at the library or now on Zoom called Mitten, Tails, and Talk. It's a program where I read a short story out loud and then we discuss it together, and all of the stories relate to Michigan in some way. This month's story is called The Beloved Murderer, and it's by James Oliver Curwood, who was a writer who lived in Michigan in the late 1800s and early 1900s. He was born in 1878 and lived until 1927. He has a writing castle in the style of a French chateau on the banks of the Shiawassee River in Owosso, Michigan, that you can still visit. Although his name may be somewhat obscured by history today, he was very famous in his day, and he was based right here in Michigan. At the time of his death in 1927, according to Wikipedia, he was the highest paid writer per word in the world. Although he was based in Michigan, many of his stories are set in the wilderness somewhere, some in the Michigan wilderness, but this particular story is set in the Hudson Bay area of Canada. This story was originally published in Munsee's magazine in 1919 and is available on the Shiawassee District Library website, along with many of his other short stories and links to different novels that he's written. I hope you enjoy it and discuss with others if you choose. There are some questions posted with the podcast. And if you do enjoy it, you're welcome to join us at another month's Mitten, Tails, and Talk through the library. This is The Beloved Murderer by James Oliver Curwood. McCarring had heard the sound. He knew that it was not the falling of snow from the low-hanging spruce boughs or the crunch of an animal's paw or hoof. There was no guessing or conjecturing in his mind. He simply knew that it was human and that it sent a little shiver up his spine. He did not move hastily, for the same quick instinct told him that to move hastily was to meet sudden danger. He was bending low over his birch bark fire, arranging pieces of wood over the crackling flames. When he straightened himself, he did so slowly, and with a careless and cheery whistle, his hand resting as if by accident on the butt of his big service revolver. It was as he had expected. A man on snowshoes stood looking at him half a dozen paces away. As carelessly as if by accident, the stranger's hand, too, rested upon the butt of the revolver, which swung in a holster at his side. As McCarring had expected, the man's shaggy hair and short beard was of a reddish, auburn color like his own. In the eyes, the hair, and the form of the two men, there was a curious resemblance, though McCarring's face was smooth. He smiled and nodded. He knew the man, could have spoken his name. There were but two white men in that wild and desolate region of snow and wilderness. Himself, Dan McCarring of the Royal Northwest Mounted Police, and this other man, Scotty Grimshaw, the murderer, whose trail had baffled him up until a few hours before. He had never seen Grimshaw, but that this was the man he was certain, for the stranger answered to every line of the printed description which McCarring carried in his breast pocket. All that day he had expected to come upon Grimshaw. Instead, Grimshaw had surprised him and could undoubtedly have killed him, if he had known that McCarring was a manhunter sent out especially to run him down. For a moment, both men stood with their hands on their guns. Each was ready for action, yet neither betrayed a spark of menace to the other. McCarring saw that he had the advantage of the situation. Scotty Grimshaw did not know who he was, but he knew Scotty. He suddenly raised his hand from his pistol holder and held it out to the other. "Who in thunder are you?" he cried. The other also extended his pistol hand and gripped McCarring's. "Thompson," from the post up at Fort of God, he said. Who are you? McCaring, said the young man truthfully, for he knew that his name would be unknown. Then he tacked on an explanatory bit of fiction. I'm mapping out a timberline for the government. He dropped back to the fire, and for the first time made a careful note of his visitor. He was half startled at what he saw. Even as the man stood, smiling, he swayed in his snowshoes. He put out an arm to balance himself. Then he struggled with his long bush caribou shoes. It was an effort for him to kick them off, and when he had done it, he was breathing in a curious sort of way. As he dropped his small pack from his shoulders, there was a clatter of tinware, but the folds of the pack fell together in a way that showed it was almost empty. McCaring noticed all this, and when the other looked at him again, he saw the red telltale glow in his eyes. Over the fire which McCaring had built, a pot of tea had begun to simmer, and on the snow was a pan of sliced bacon. Scotty's eyes traveled to them hungrily, and he laughed in a half-apologetic sort of way. There was something in that laugh, something in the outlaw's face, in the pathetic droop of his shoulders, that struck a sympathetic chord in McCaring's heart. A flush entered into the other's storm-beaten face when he saw that McCaring had guessed the truth. You're hungry, said McCaring. Starving, replied Grimshaw quietly and still smiling. I haven't had a mouthful of grub in 3 days and two nights, and when you're fighting storm and this cold... He stopped with an ugly cough. In an instant, McCaring had him by the arm. McCaring was young in the service. He was ambitious. The word had gone out that the capture of Scotty Grimshaw, the murderer who had eluded the best men in the service for a year, would mean a sergeantcy for the lucky man who brought him in and $1,500 in cold cash. But in this moment, he forgot that the man whose arm he gripped was the murderer. He had not seen a white face for more than 2 months, and the outlaw's countenance was a strong, blue-eyed, likable one, thinned by hunger. As he half-dragged the man toward the soft pile of balsam boughs and blankets inside the small tent that he had pitched for the night, a plan of action leapt quickly through McCaring's mind. There would be time to make the arrest. Later. They would have supper first. As Grimshaw dropped down on the blankets facing the fire, he laughed again in that nervous, apologetic way, and his eyes hung to McCaring's face. McCaring noticed that he carelessly swung his pistol holster around in front of him so that it was easy at hand. 3 days without grub is a long time up here, said McCaring. What's the matter? Lost my compass and have missed my trail ever since, replied Scotty. That was 12 or 15 days ago. I've forgotten just how many. It beats all how big and empty this country is when you're lost. McCaring was raking together a bed of coals for the bacon. A few minutes later, the two were sitting facing each other, close to the fire, with meat, bannock, and a big tin of beans between them. Fill up, invited McCaring. Don't be afraid of overstocking. I travel with two dogs and a sledge. They're over there in that bit of sheltered bush. I've got plenty of grub. He could see that Grimshaw was trying to hide his starvation as much as possible, and it made him like the man, in spite of the fact that he knew what he was. Grimshaw's crime had been a shocking one, but no one could have suspected his record from appearances. It was some time before he seemed at ease and began to eat a little more ravenously. When McCaring opened a second can of beans, he protested. McCaring insisted, and he cleaned the tin. Suddenly, McCaring reached halfway across the narrow space and separated them. That's the curious carving on your gun. Would you mind letting me take a look at it? For an instant, Scotty Grimshaw's eyes darkened. The two men looked straight at each other, McCarring, smiling carelessly as he pointed at the gun. The outlaw's laugh was a little harsher as he pulled out the weapon. Sure, he said. It's an old gun. Had it for 15 years. Take a look at it. He held it across to McCarring, butt first, his left hand slipping into his coat pocket at the same time. Scarcely had McCarring taken the weapon when the other man's hand appeared with a murderous-looking little Savage automatic. But this is a still queerer one, he added, and there was a curious glitter in his smiling eyes. 10 shots, quick as lightning, he went on, passing the automatic to his right hand and never for an instant taking his eyes from McCarring. Goodness knows what gun makers won't do next. McCarring felt a warm flush in his face. Even now, the outlaw had the drop on him. But he felt no uneasiness or chagrin at that fact. He admired the other's careless generalship. He was confident, also, that Scotty would offer him no harm so long as he did not make the first aggressive move. So he returned the revolver, but first, and with a good-natured laugh, brushed his cap back until it fell from his head. He half turned about to pick it up, falling off his guard easily and with no show of fear. Scotty's pistol arm stiffened. For an instant, the muzzle of his revolver covered McCarring, and he stared hard at the other's bare head. When McCarring turned again, however, the outlaw's arm had fallen, and he was poking his gun into its holster. You're red-headed, same as me, he remarked. Not red, objected McCarring, as Scotty took off his own cap to prove his own particular feature. Not red, but mighty near it. I'm not very good at colors when they overlap, said Scotty. Mine's red, that's what I call it. Now, if yours ain't red, then what in the name of Sam Hill is it? Auburn, said McCarring confidently. Look here. He thrust a hand suddenly into his breast pocket, drew out a flat, buckskin-covered object, and quickly revealed a photograph. During the last 9 months, McCarring had not met a white man to whom he had not shown that picture. He held it out to the wondering gaze of the outlaw. Look there, he urged again, and his face was flushed with a sudden glow. She calls it Auburn. Hadn't she ought to know? A pure, sweet, girlish face smiled out of the picture into Scotty Grimshaw's staring eyes. He stared at it long and intently, and McCarring noticed that his fingers trembled a little. Your sister? He asked at last in a low voice. No, she's going to be my wife. Scotty gave the picture back. The eyes of the two men met. She's going to be my wife, said McCarring again, and his voice trembled with unspoken joy as he looked down into the face that seemed to smile at him still more sweetly. She's going to be my wife when I get out of this. Scotty's hand touched his arm. In amazement, he saw that between the outlaw's fingers, there was another photograph. He took it. It was a young woman's face that looked out of this picture, a little less girlish than the other, but with wonderful dark eyes which seemed almost alive in the firelight and which thrilled him with their sadness. Your sister? He asked and tried to smile at his attempted joke. The outlaw's voice was so low and tender that it seemed filled with reverence. My wife, he said. Your wife? Startled, stung almost to pain by a sudden thought, McCarring stared again at the picture. For a few moments, he did not wish Scotty Grimshaw to see his face. The outlaw's wife? The dark eyes gazed up at McCarring almost pleadingly. Their wonderful beauty stirred his soul. They seemed to be filled with an unspoken prayer, a prayer for him. The murderer's wife. He had never thought of that, had never guessed that Scotty Grimshaw might have a wife. He turned the picture over, and there, in faded writing, he wrote, "To my darling boy," he read, "to my darling boy, from the girl who will think of him every hour and pray for him on her knees each night until he comes back to her. And he must always remember his genie." With a sudden exclamation, McCarran caught himself and returned the photograph to Grimshaw. "Pardon me, old man," he said. "I didn't mean to read that." "Glad you did," said Scotty. And his smile was filled with the warmth of love which those words brought home to him. "I've read 'em a million times. I look at the picture every night before I turn in, and it makes me dream. Only sometimes..." "What?" "Sometimes," said Scotty, a strange look stealing into his eyes, "I wish she hadn't been so sad that day when it was taken. It was the day I came away, and she had been crying a long time. That's why her eyes, why, confound it, they're almost crying now, you know." There was a moment's huskiness in the outlaw's voice. "I noticed that," replied McCarran softly. "But there's love there too, old man. It's love that makes them look like that, love and grief. I wish..." He looked at the smiling face in his own photograph and then added, a little regretfully, "Maybe if she'd had her picture taken on the day I left, there would have been more of that in her eyes. But this was taken a year before. She cried, too." "You haven't seen her in a long time?" 11 months. "But she writes me 3 letters a week, and there's always a stack of them waiting for me somewhere. And you?" "A year," said Scotty. "God bless her dear heart. She writes me often enough, I know, but the letters don't reach me very often. It won't be long now. If I don't get out of this and go down to her, she's coming up to meet me in the spring." McCarran was unbuckling his pistol belt. He tossed the weapon on the blankets back in the tent. For an instant, the softness left Scotty Grimshaw's face. Then he laughed, and there was a nervousness in the laugh. "These things are uncomfortable," he said, and he tossed his weapon in beside McCarran's. He pulled out his automatic. "This thing has been wearing a hole in my side for 3 days," he added, and the third weapon followed the others. For a flash, their eyes met again. Then McCarran reached across for the picture of the dark-haired wife. He placed the two photographs side by side on the blanket between them in the glow of the fire. "Ladies present," he cried, with another attempt at humor, and then he stopped short. Both men stared at the pictures as if the same wonderful discovery had leapt in a lightning flash through both their minds. McCarran looked up. "Do you notice anything queer about them?" he asked. "Is she your wife? Looking straight over there at you?" "Yes," said Scotty. "And mine, too. My girl is looking at me." "I guess it's just the way they happened to be sitting when the pictures were taken," explained Scotty. "But it's queer, and by George, I say it's mighty nice to have it that way," exclaimed McCarran. He settled back comfortably and began filling his pipe. "I wish she'd had it taken with her hair down in a big braid," he said. "That's the way she always wears it, ever has, as since she was a kid. It was that way when we were out in the old orchard that day, away down in a little village in Illinois. The apple blossoms were out," he went on, "red and white and pink, so thick that every tree looked like one big flower. I can smell them now. She got a start of me, a good big one, and made me run to catch her, and when I came up to her, she was shaking flowers all over like a snowstorm, and her hair was loose and shining all about her, and her eyes..." He stopped, half breathless, and laughed softly into Scotty Grimshaw's tense face. "That's when I popped the question. he finished. She laughed and then cried, and I... He puffed out a thick cloud of smoke that hid his face. Scotty chuckled with sympathetic understanding. I don't know whether mine laughed or cried, he said, leaning a little farther back into the gloom, because I was so scared that I asked her in writing. He leaned over again until his face was in the fire glare and spoke confidentially. You know, that picture doesn't flatter her. She is pretty, prettier to me than any other woman I've ever known. It was her eyes that floored me. They were scared me stiff. They were so big and bright and soft. When I wrote her, I couldn't believe I had a ghost of a chance. I had to pinch myself to make sure all was true when I got her reply. When I went to see her, he stopped and settled back into the gloom again, leaving McCarring to understand. A question shot into McCarring's head. Any kids? He asked. One, said Scotty, and his words sent another of those strangely uncomfortable chills through McCarring. You see, I didn't know, and he was born after I left. You've never seen him? No. A boy? Yes, a boy, a Buster, 10 pounds when he came. She's named the little codger after me, you know, and she says she shows him my picture half a dozen times a day. He's chewed up 2 already, according to her last letter. There was a silence, and the fire burned low. Beyond the edge of the timber line, they could hear a rising wind beginning to wail over the barren. McCarring spoke. I guess I'd like a girl, he said. 5 or 6 of them. He could hear Scotty chuckling. You want to wish for boys, then, he advised. That's what she says. Wish for what you don't want and you'll get the other. Funny how we remember all these things up here, ain't it? You don't appreciate what an angel a good woman is until you've been away from them for a long time. I haven't seen a white woman in 7 months. Not quite so bad here, replied McCarring. Only 4, but it's been like 4 years. But it does a man good sometimes, came Scotty's voice from out of the deepening darkness. And then again, it may act the other way and make him bad, a sort of beast, a murderer, for instance, snapped McCarring. There was a half minute of terrible silence. Each man could hear the other breathing, could almost feel the tenseness of the other's body. I was thinking of that, said Scotty at last. The want of a woman's hands and a woman's voice sometimes makes a man kill another man. Perhaps, after all, he isn't so very much to blame. Now and then, there may possibly be a good excuse for killing. McCarring rose and began throwing fresh logs upon the fire. Then he turned to Scotty Grimshaw, who had also risen to his feet. We'd better get to bed, he said. I'm tired. He went into the tent and rearranged the blankets while Scotty peered in at him from the door. The 2 big revolvers and the automatic he hung on the tent cord. He began undressing and Scotty followed suit. An hour later, they were asleep, side by side, the murderer and the manhunter, with the flames from the crackling logs throwing dancing shadows into the tent and lighting up their faces. McCarring's last thought was that he would do his duty in the morning. It would be an unpleasant task, but he must do it. After breakfast, he would arrest Scotty Grimshaw, the man killer. The night fell deeper and more silent, except for the wailing of the wind over the barren. And McCarring had a dream. It was a dream of 2 women, one young and blue-eyed with frolicsome masses of gold-brown hair the other older and darker with eyes that seemed to look out of heaven. The former was kneeling at the latter's feet, her face buried in the older woman's lap, and the great dark eyes seemed staring straight at him as their possessor stroked the gold-brown head. He awoke, shivering. The fire was out. A few dull coals glowed in the darkness. He remembered Scotty and put out a groping hand. The other half of the bed was empty. For a few moments, he half sat up, holding his breath. Then he moved toward the door, rose cautiously to his feet, and searched for the hanging weapons. One of the big guns and the automatic were gone. His own remained. He listened for a long time and heard nothing. He stared outside and could see nothing. Then he built up the fire, laughing a little savagely as he thought how the cautious Scotty Grimshaw murderer had given him the slip. But after all, was he sorry? Would he have arrested Scotty in the morning? He looked at his watch. It was already morning. The cold, black, silent morning of the Great Baron. It was 4 o'clock. The fire burned more brightly and lit up the tent. Not until then did McCarring see the folded bit of paper tacked to the tent flap, with black marks drawn around it with a charred stick to attract his attention. He took it down and opened it close to the fire. It was Scotty Grimshaw's farewell note. It read thus: "I've weakened at the last moment, old man. I've been on your trail a long time, but when I came in starving and half frozen, and you had treated me so well, I couldn't do what I planned to do. And then, when you brought her out, I thought of my own little girl at home, and I couldn't take your life away from you. I've taken half your grub, but you're getting off cheap at that. Go back to her. Name that first little girl after my genie and write to me someday. I knew you were Scotty Grimshaw from the moment I laid eyes on you, but I can't take you in. Goodbye. Sergeant William McRain, Royal Northwest Mounted Police, North Division, Fullerton Point." Dan McCarring read and reread the note. Then he laughed. And his laugh rang out above the wailing of the wind on the barren, above the crackling of the fire. He folded the note and placed it in his breast pocket. Someday, quite soon, he would show it to the girl and tell her the story. Then they would hunt up Mr. and Mrs. William McRain. With the light of day, he was prepared to take up once more the trail of Scotty Grimshaw, murderer. The end.